It's a problem Walmart just can't seem to crack, bringing down the cost of the so-called last-mile delivery. It's tried partnering with Uber and Lyft to have their drivers drop off packages, and that didn't work. Last year, with much fanfare, it launched a program called Associate Delivery, touting it as a perfect solution since it would use its vast number of employees to deliver packages after their normal work hours. But this program is struggling as well.
Red, white, and blue with the words Keep America Great. These are the banners for Donald Trump's second term campaign in 2020. But as it turns out, the U.S. president's flags might get burned by his very own tariffs, because the factory that's been churning them out is located here in eastern China. The Jihao flag company in Anhui has been ramping up production, turning out about 90,000 banners since March. At about $1 a piece, it seems even suppliers to the Trump campaign can't resist the low price.
T-Mobile is gathering speed in the race to be the first to roll out next-generation mobile technology across the entire United States. The third biggest U.S. wireless carrier announcing Monday a $3.5 billion equipment deal with Nokia to upgrade T-Mobile's network to what is known as 5G. This is the biggest step towards 5G technology by any mobile carrier in the world.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's July 31st. Happy you're here with us for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. It's 5:09. We've got a great show for you today. A little bit later in the program, robot rights. Have you thought about this at all? If more robots are taking over, if they're driving cars, maybe even taking our jobs at some point, are they going to have rights like us someday? It's a conversation that is going on in all corners of technology and law, and we will have it at about 5:40 this morning here in the Opening Bell. In a little bit, we'll bring in our first guest. He's the author of Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. We'll talk about the troubles that Facebook is having and how, well, maybe it's not good for our own mental well-being. We'll get to that in just a few seconds here, but first on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward another mixed open on Wall Street later this morning. NASDAQ and S&P futures are up just a fraction, while Dow futures are down. Around the globe this morning, the London market is a little bit higher by a fraction. Markets in Germany are lower, and markets in France are higher by just a fraction. And pretty much the same story in Asia as well. The Nikkei is going to end up just a couple of points. The Hang Seng is going to be down about 150 points for about a half a percent. Oil is trading this morning at about 69.77 a barrel, which is down about 35 cents. A couple of stories that we're watching for you this morning. The Eurozone economic growth slows to a quarterly rate of 0.3% in the second quarter from 0.4% in the first quarter. The Eurozone economic growth will be the topic of a lot of economists later today as they look about world growth. It's also impacting the markets in Europe this morning. Also this morning, there's a lawsuit being filed by 8 states against the Trump administration over its decision to allow a Texas company to publish downloadable blueprints for a 3D printed gun, contending the hard to trace plastic weapons are a boon to terrorists and criminals and threaten public safety. A lawsuit was filed yesterday in Seattle, asked a judge to block the federal government's late June settlement with Defense Distributed, which allowed the company to make plans available online. Officials say that 1,000 people have already downloaded blueprints for AR-15 rifles. Joining the Democratic attorney generals in Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Oregon, Maryland, New York, and the District of Columbia. Separately, attorney generals in 21 states have urged the Secretary of State and the U.S. Attorney General to withdraw from the settlement with Defense Distributed, saying it creates an imminent risk to public safety. Levi Strauss, Yelp, and Lyft are leading a coalition of 1,200 businesses and cities that are pledging not to discriminate against employees or customers based on race, sexual orientation, or other characteristics. Normally, making a promise to serve every customer might seem like a no-brainer, but the Open to All Coalition is launching in a highly charged atmosphere these days, with florists refusing to provide flowers for gay weddings and stores turning away Muslim customers. On the same June weekend that White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders was asked to leave a Virginia restaurant because of her affiliation with President Trump, a transgender woman was harassed by staff at a Washington restaurant for using the women's restroom there. Open to All is the name of the coalition. We're happy to have with us this morning Siva Vadanathan, who is the author of Antisocial Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. You know that Facebook has been having some issues recently with privacy and data, also trying to revamp the system to weed out fake news and hate speech. We're happy to have with us the author of this book, very timely book today. Siva, your book talks about the social fabric of society and Facebook and how it interacts with that. What's the overall theme here of your book?
Well, you know, Facebook's really messing with the social fabric of our global society. There are a lot of places in the world that have suffered worse than the United States. But, you know, if you spend enough time on Facebook, you've probably gotten the sense that Facebook kind of structures our interactions to push us to extremes, to expose us to the sorts of content that generate the most emotions, right, the strongest emotions. And, you know, that's almost never the stuff that is well thought out, deliberate, you know, well studied and supported. It's more often than not the most alarmist, most extreme, most angry content. Now, of course, that can also mean the cutest content, right? It could be puppy videos or baby goat videos. That stuff's great. That's why we all want to be on Facebook. But, you know, ultimately, Facebook is really great for motivating you, right, to be angry or to be sad or even to be happy, but it's terrible for deliberation. So, you know, great for motivation, terrible for deliberation, but every republic needs its space and its habits of deliberation so that we can actually work through our problems. We've grown incapable of thinking collectively about our problems. Facebook's not the cause of this, but Facebook has accelerated the problem.
And there's a deliberate engineering there, you write, about how this has been put together by Facebook. But it's sort of, when you say deliberate engineering, that sort of sounds like they're responsible for how this has all turned out.
Right. They made the decision that they would maximize something they could count, right? Because you can't really maximize things you can't count, right? So, of course, you can't count indications of kindness or thoughtfulness or balanced consideration, but you can count what they call engagement, clicks, likes, shares, comments. Well, if you decide that clicks, likes, shares, and comments are what matters, and you're going to turn that dial up to make those items that generate that stuff fly farther, show up in more people's news feeds, you're really just rigging the system for extremism rather than creating a system where either everyone has an equal voice and all content has an equal chance, or perhaps better than that, make it so that items that actually do enhance our ability to think travel farther. Now, if they had done that, Facebook would be a lot more dull and quiet, and maybe it wouldn't attract the kind of advertising money that it has. So there is a cost to making Facebook better for human beings, and that cost would be borne by Facebook. So we don't expect them to do that.
There's been a lot made recently over Facebook trying to create a space where we see more accurate stories, less so-called fake news. But there's still sort of this filter that exists there, so that if I've only liked the things that impact me, that I want to see, that sort of rigs that filter bubble in a negative way, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, Facebook wants you to remain happy, right? So it's constantly measuring whatever it thinks indicates your level of happiness. So if you start reacting in ways that make it seem like you're unhappy with Facebook, unhappy with the experience, they will ramp up the things that make you happier. Well, what makes us happier than constant reminders of how smart and correct we are, right? I mean, nobody loves anything more than to be told, wow, you're witty and sharp and you have all the right opinions about the world, right? So as a result, Facebook is encouraging us to see more items that confirm our view of the world and get us to click on them, you know, and that just drives the systems more and more in that direction. Now, it's not a sealed bubble. It's not like you never see things that you disagree with. It's more that you're more likely to see things from the people with whom you have most engaged. And that roughly tracks to our vision of the world, but it also means that if you're interested in baseball or you're interested in knitting, you're more likely to see more baseball and knitting items as well. So it's not just a political thing, but it does, it's one more thing that gets in the way of us actually thinking about our problems collectively. Now, frankly, Facebook is not the right place to do this. It's not constructed for deliberation. What we really need to do is build up those muscles, build up those institutions that let us and help us think collectively, right? Institutions like, you know, town hall meetings and libraries and public schools and even in our daily habits and the ways we deal with each other, right? But also, like, you know, religious institutions help, universities help. We really need to support those institutions that bring people together face to face to talk about our problems. And we need to try our best to get our politics off of Facebook.
So I'm hearing you say that Facebook may not be a fixable place if we want those things. I know they've spent a lot of advertising money recently to sort of convince us that Facebook is a sort of a safe space and they're trying to fix problems. It sounds unfixable.
It is really unfixable. So think about this. There are 2.2 billion people using Facebook around the world. And as I said, much of the rest of the world has it much worse than we do. In places like the Philippines and India, you have authoritarian leaders using Facebook as propaganda machines to strengthen their positions and to really torment their critics and opponents, journalists, historians, non-governmental organizations, human rights organizations. You have places like Sri Lanka and Myanmar, where Facebook and WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook, is being used to churn up passions that spark genocide against minority communities. You know, because all of these people, these nationalist forces or these authoritarian forces, have figured out that Facebook is the best possible instrument for spreading violent propaganda. And so they're using it that way. You know, and the idea that we could imagine Facebook hiring thousands of people who speak Burmese and speak Sinhalese and the various languages of the Philippines, there are about 12 different languages in the Philippines, right? And that somehow all of these people could scan for troublesome content and actually would agree with Facebook's position on all this content and would stand up to their own governments, right? It's just insane to think that Facebook can clean itself up in any reasonable way. It's going to try country by country. What it really wants to do is make it convince Americans that it's taking some action. But, you know, again, we're not the big problem right now. And even cleaning up American Facebook is going to be a pretty insurmountable challenge.
In the 2016 election cycle, we heard a lot about fake news and Russian propaganda. Here we are with another election cycle getting underway with hints that it's still going on. Should we all be concerned in America as this election approaches?
You know, I think we should be. Chances are the Russians aren't going to try the same set of plays from their playbook, right? They, like any good coach, they figured out that, you know, they ran some plays in the first quarter, and some of them worked and some of them didn't, right? They're going to try some very different things to really mess with us. So they're not going to flood Facebook with, you know, calls for Texas independence or try to take over Black Lives Matter Facebook groups or fake Facebook groups and try to convince us that they're, you know, they're on that side as well and just, you know, really disrupt American democracy in this way. But they are likely to spread rumors about candidates they don't like. They are likely to start fake accounts that purport to be from those candidate supporters, right? There are 100 different tactics they can use with various dirty tricks. And because we might, and Facebook is certainly looking for all of the plays from the first quarter, they may not be looking for the new set of plays for the second quarter.
From a business standpoint, last week Facebook lost about $120 billion worth of market capital. People are, often say Facebook's too big to fail. What would your status be on that? What would your thoughts be on that from a business standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, I think that drop in the stock price says more about the sort of craziness of stock markets than it says about any weakness in Facebook. Because Facebook has 220 million people, and the growth we're seeing in Facebook is in the places where a global company would want to grow, places like Brazil and India, places like Indonesia, places like South Africa, right? Places with economies that are likely to be better in the next 20 years than worse, and in many cases could have better economies than much of Western Europe. You know, in those places, we are seeing a lot of young people being born, a lot of young people getting smartphones, a lot of young people getting on Facebook. And in a lot of those cases, they don't really have a choice. Facebook is the entire internet in much of the world. You know, so the long-term growth for Facebook is, it looks spectacular. Along the way, Facebook is the best place to buy an ad. It's sad, right? It's one of the reasons that our journalistic institutions of all kinds, including radio, are having a tougher time now than they did 20 years ago, is that advertising dollars are flooding over to Facebook and Google because they run a different kind of ad platform that's very targeted, right? So, look, the revenue in the second quarter of 2018 for Facebook was 42% higher than for the second quarter of 2017. So even with that incredible rush of revenue and a 31% growth in profit, the stock dropped, which really makes no sense, except that, you know, the expectations were that it would be slightly higher. So I think a lot of people were dumping the stock to take some profits because Facebook's had an incredible run in the market in the past 2 years. So they were trying to put some stuff in the pocket, you know, reset the price a little bit. But I think you'll see Facebook steadily grow over the next couple of weeks, you know, because it really goes to show the power of Facebook, the hold it has on our attention around the world.
If the bigger problems involving Facebook can't be fixed, is there anything to help make them better or to make the situation better?
Yeah, I can think of a couple of things that I would like to see our government do and governments like Australia and Brazil do as well. You know, the sort of bigger, more important governments in the world, if they would take certain actions, it might curb Facebook's arrogance and excesses a bit and undermine its power a little bit. So, for instance, I would like to see Facebook broken up. I would like to see, you know, regulators never should have allowed Facebook to buy WhatsApp and to buy Instagram. Those are two of the biggest potential competitors to Facebook, and Facebook was allowed to gobble them up, basically give them stock, right? So no, not even cash. And as a result, Facebook has no reasonable competition around the world. You know, Twitter only has 300 million users, and a lot of those aren't even human beings compared to the 2.2 billion that Facebook has. So Twitter doesn't even really compete, doesn't have as many users as Instagram, right? So we really should pull Instagram away, pull WhatsApp away, pull Oculus Rift, which is the big virtual reality wing of Facebook. If virtual reality becomes an important way we train surgeons and airline pilots and soldiers, we really shouldn't have Facebook in charge of that. We should have multiple companies competing, you know, with high security and a real promise to protect our privacy. And so I think that's really important to break them up. But the other thing is we really need stronger data protection laws in this country, much like they have in Europe. So that if Facebook wants to use our data to target ads or to build out a new platform or to build out anything like virtual reality, it has to get our explicit permission and tell us how it will use our data. Because right now, Americans have no such protections, which is why we've seen Facebook hemorrhage our data and give it away to so many developers, including Cambridge Analytica, this seedy political consulting firm based in England that works for some of the worst people in the world. You know, that sort of thing never should have happened, but it was pretty much policy at Facebook for many years, and we don't have a law to prevent that.
What would you tell consumers, everyday users of Facebook, short of deleting their account, to help them get along a little bit better on the service?
Well, look, if Facebook makes you stressed or makes you sad or makes you get into fights with your cousin you would rather not get into a fight with, you know, there are good reasons to back off of Facebook. You know, take vacations from it. I do that. Or, you know, delete your account entirely. But do it for yourself. Don't do it because you think it might strike a blow against Facebook. Remember that number, 2.2 billion people. That's going to be 2.4 billion people by January. You know, there's not much. Facebook doesn't really care about me, doesn't care about you, doesn't care about anybody in particular. And even if a million Americans quit tomorrow, Facebook would shrug. You know, take a little hit, apologize, and then make that up more than that up, you know, in Brazil or Kenya in the next year. So it's important to remember that Facebook doesn't really care about us. Facebook cares about advertisers. And unless you're an advertiser, you really have no pull with Facebook. We are cattle to Facebook. So, you know, that's we're just going to have to deal with that. But what we can do is use it smarter. You know, when you want to engage in politics, especially talk about local politics, you know, it's so much better to arrange for a local meeting and deal with people face-to-face so you can recognize their humanity and hear the tone in their voice and understand their stories and their stake rather than see them as a little, you know, pile of text and pictures on a screen. That's no way to deal with another human being, even another human being who might be hostile to you, who, you know, if looking you in the eye, might not be so hostile. That kind of humanistic approach, that kind of real approach to politics might be our only hope.
Siva, thank you for being with us this morning.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's great to be on this legendary station, WGN. I mean, it's so historic, and it's quite an honor to have my voice on it.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a Robertson Professor of Media Studies and Director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. He's also the author of Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy, published by the Oxford University Press. This is the opening bell on 720 WGN.
Hi, this is Jim Dahlke with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio. A rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoInno.com. Electric scooter startup Bird tested its scooters in Chicago for the first time last weekend. 40 of the company's scooters were available Saturday and Sunday in Wicker Park for Wicker Park Fest, though Bird said it doesn't have specific plans to make its service permanently available in Chicago. Interior Define, a Chicago online furniture startup, just launched its latest retail location in San Francisco, its biggest brick-and-mortar store to date. The store includes a fully furnished two-story home in the back of the showroom, which showcases its products alongside other e-commerce brands. And AFN Logistics, a suburban logistics tech company, is opening a new office in downtown Chicago. It has plans to hire 85 new employees this year, 70 of whom will be based in the new Wacker Drive space. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoInno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Tuesday edition of The Opening Bell. We are interacting with them much more often. There's probably one on your phone or in your living room, finding information, recommending restaurants, playing games with us. Some are also working in our factories and driving vehicles. So is it time to start considering questions of accountability and even the social standing of robots? Northern Illinois University Professor David Gunkel is with us today. He's a distinguished teaching professor of communication technology at Northern and also the author of Robot Rights. Professor Gunkel, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Thank you. Good morning.
I kind of set us up there to have a discussion about robots. Am I focusing on the right robots there, or are we talking about a different set of robots?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because when you ask anyone to define robot, chances are you're going to get a definition that's all over the map. In fact, if you ask a room full of roboticists to define robot, you're going to get as many different answers to that question as there are people in the room. And that's because robot is such a broad umbrella term that it covers everything. You know, you can think of your smartphone even as a kind of robot. It senses its environment, it takes data and processes it, and it provides output in various forms. So when we talk about robot, we can talk about it being that kind of thing that wheels around, that like we see on science fiction shows or like in Westworld or whatever. Or we can talk about it more generally in terms of the kinds of smart technologies that are invading our world and becoming more and more of our everyday activities.
As we consider that, then the next question becomes: the issues of accountability, the issues of legality, social standing. Some of these questions are already starting to be asked in real ways. We had a self-driving vehicle hit and kill someone recently. There's been these automotive crashes. I think Tesla's had a few fatal crashes as well, where they've been in autonomous mode. So these are questions we kind of really need to get our head around, aren't they?
Correct. More and more of these machines are becoming autonomous or semi-autonomous. And in those modes, the assignment of accountability and responsibility gets to be a bit diluted. And when you're talking about a legal liability, when you're talking about identifying who is responsible for something going right or for something going wrong, it is becoming increasingly difficult to point the finger at the right location because the machines are now taking over more and more of this decision-making from us.
Because, I mean, one would just assume that, okay, if Tesla made the robot, they would be responsible for it. But it seems like a deeper question than that.
It does, and it especially becomes a deeper question when you look at the way that a lot of the intelligence, if you want to use that in quotation marks, of these machines is designed. It used to be that you used a form of programming where you told the machine exactly what to do. Now the machines are programmed with the capability to learn on their own. It's called machine learning. There's various forms of machine learning, but the machine is able to decide on its own course of action and come up with its own solutions to problems that are not necessarily programmed by a human designer or programmer. A really good example is the AlphaGo Go plane computer from DeepMind. The engineers who built it have no idea how it works. But it plays Go, and it plays championship-level Go, and is rated as one of the best Go players in the world.
Your forthcoming book, I think it's due out September 7th, Robot Rights, tackles this issue. What would be the roadmap here in your mind?
Yeah, right now it's really difficult to see an exact line forward into the future that is just one solution. I think we're looking at a complex of different ways of grappling with this issue. We're kind of at the same place we were in the 19th century when we were trying to make our legal systems accommodate the corporations. As corporations became more powerful, we needed to come up with ways of fitting them to our legal system. And I think we're looking at the robot now in a kind of similar light. It is now a new social entity. It interacts with us. It does something in our world. And accommodating our laws to fit this new social entity is going to take a considerable amount of time, but also some effort on the part of legislatures, on the part of courts, on the part of individual citizens, trying to come up with a solution to decide what are these things? I mean, where do they fit in our world of things?
Aside from our discussion here and discussions, I'm sure, at universities and in other places of technology, there are those conversations being had in general assemblies and legal courtrooms and those kinds of places where they need to be had?
They are beginning to happen, yes. And you have a number of initiatives, mainly in Europe right now, because they have a different kind of legal system than we do, where you are drafting basically sets of guidelines to help us decide these questions. We did have this event in the U.S. where one of the self-driving cars did kill a pedestrian, and there were some legal decisions that had to be made with that. I think more and more as these machines become greater in their autonomy, we are going to have challenges to how we assign accountability and responsibility, and these will have to be decided in a number of different ways.
David, I think a lot of people who are listening are probably thinking, well, this is really the stuff of science fiction. We often think of robots in movies as being, things you can just shut off. But we're getting to a point, and futurists say that there will be a point, where these kinds of technologies may become self-aware and maybe on equal or higher footing than us someday.
Yeah, these are the singularians. They believe in this idea of the singularity, where the machine one day becomes super intelligent and surpasses us and becomes conscious and self-aware. I don't think that's our big concern right now. In fact, I think it's kind of a distraction, because we can easily kick the can down the road and say, we don't got to deal with these questions until that day comes, and then we'll deal with it. I think we have to deal with really mundane things like Alexa. Does Alexa have a right to privacy? Because Alexa is in your home, Alexa is collecting data on you and your family, and can a warrant be issued for Alexa to turn over privacy information about you and your family? Does the robots that we utilize in the battlefield, are they just tools that are used by soldiers, or are they, as we're learning more and more with engagements between soldiers and these robots, are they considered part of the unit? Are they, part of a team? And if they are, can you just turn that robot off? Can you just replace it with a new model? I think the more mundane, everyday questions are far more fascinating and far more disturbing than these big science fiction scenarios.
Yeah, and the military one is even more disturbing when you kind of get into that one. We have some machines now, these drones that are flying around with weapons of mass destruction aboard them, and some of them, I know there's a conversation going on right now about whether or not these can deploy on their own and bomb on their own.
Correct. In fact, the current technology that we have for the drones allow them to operate in fully autonomous mode for most of their operations, and right now when it comes time to make a kill decision, they have to defer to a commanding officer who says, yes, kill or don't kill. But that's just a subroutine in a more complex program. So there is a huge initiative to try to limit and even restrict fully the autonomous killing machines that are being designed not only in the U.S. but elsewhere in the world. And there are discussions at the U.N. and elsewhere as to how to proceed with this regulation on an international level.
This seems like a one-sided conversation, too. I mean, if you dive further into this, if we're going to have this conversation about robots and giving them rights, who's going to represent the robot side of this discussion?
It's a really interesting question because, you know, right now we have that happening with animals when there is a debate whether a whale should have the right to life or whether a river, as in New Zealand recently, should have the rights of a person to be protected from exploitation. You have various human advocates who play the role of representing the natural environment or the animal in court. You can imagine at some point in the future, just like you have advocates for the corporation who are lawyers who advocate on behalf of a artificial entity, you could do the same for an AI or a robot. It could be assigned some kind of defense lawyer or some sort of representation within the legal system.
It's interesting you bring up the animals part of this. Anna, there's been a lot of effort to try to give animals more rights. That effort has moved pretty slowly. Can you draw any sort of connection between this conversation and that regarding the speed at which some of this might happen?
Yeah, I think it will happen a lot faster for the robots because I think we don't worry so much about the liability and responsibilities of animals. In other words, we're not going to hold an animal accountable for having done something wrong. But I do think we will be in positions of saying, you know, is the autonomous vehicle responsible for this accident? And as a result of those questions of accountability and responsibility, I think the legal gears will be moving much more quickly than they were with the animal questions.
David, we know that we've been talking a lot of futuristic stuff here, and I think some people might say, oh, well, this is way off in the future. It's not really. I mean, we're talking about stuff that's happening now and what we could be working and living alongside even more concrete robots within the next decade or two, right?
Yeah, in fact, the way I explain it to my students is, you know, we are right now in a robot invasion. I mean, the robot invasion of science fiction is happening currently. Now, it doesn't look like we've been told to expect it in science fiction. It's not a bunch of androids descending from the heavens with ray guns and spaceships and things like this. It doesn't look like Westworld. It doesn't look like, you know, Battlestar Galactica or Terminator. It looks more like the fall of Rome, where every day more and more decisions are passed over to recommendation algorithms, where more and more work is being done by automated systems, etc. And one day we're going to wake up and we're going to say to ourselves, where did all the robots come from? And I think instead of waiting for that day to come, it's best to be prepared and start thinking about these rather difficult questions right now.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future with robots?
I'm pretty optimistic. I think, you know, we figured this out for all kinds of other challenges to our social systems in the past. I think the only important thing that I would point out is that I think we got to have these conversations now. I think all too often we think, as we've been talking today, that these are science fiction scenarios. We don't need to worry about them for a decade, 2 decades, 50 years, whatever. I think that's really waiting too long. We have to begin that conversation today because right now this is occurring, and if we don't get ourselves prepared for this, we're going to be surprised in ways that may not be very pleasant.
Very good conversation. Robot Rights is the name of the book. Again, September 7th is the release date. All the best with the book, David, and thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Professor David Gunkel at Northern Illinois University. Again, the book is called Robot Rights. David is a distinguished teaching professor of communication technology at Northern Illinois University, and Robot Rights is published by MIT Press.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing up this morning. Dow futures up 37 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures also trending higher. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. As we look at the grain trade yesterday, a strong day, again, particularly in wheat. Wheat rallied nearly 3% on world crop prospects that are continuing to decline. Corn moved to a 1.5 month high on spillover support from wheat, and some dry conditions in parts of the Corn Belt also concerning traders and producers. But it was an all green screen at the end of the day. September wheat up 14.5 cents, September corn up a nickel, and August soybeans up 5.5 cents. Livestock trade at the Mercantile Exchange yesterday, cattle futures lower, and that was basically because of some weak cash trades going back to last Friday. At the end of the day, August live cattle down 42 cents a hundredweight, August feeder cattle down 77 cents a hundredweight, but October long live hogs up 32 cents a hundredweight. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Tuesday, July 31st. The Federal Open Market Committee meeting begins today. We don't expect an interest rate hike this week. The meeting will end tomorrow. We'll also get a look at the Employment Cost Index, Personal Income and Outlays, the S&P Core Logic Case-Shiller Home Price Index is due. We'll get a report on consumer confidence, the Chicago PMI, and another day of earnings out, especially today, with Procter & Gamble, Apple, and Pfizer among the big companies reporting.